Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 213, Songs of Enlightenment.
Identification of the Mother, an Enlightenment Song, by Tiangyal Rorwe Dorje, who was born 1717 and passed on 1786, I think. And he was a great friend, colleague, and student of 7th Dalai Lama. And then he was teacher and co-student, maybe, with the 8th Dalai Lama in the 18th century. And he helped protect Tibet very much, because of his relationship with the Manchu Emperor Qianlong, who reigned for 59 years and 364 days, abdicating one day before the 60th year of his reign, because his grandfather had reigned for 60 years and he didn't want to be longer than his grandfather. And he was the last really great Manchu Emperor. He's the one who started relating to the Europeans. But anyway, I'm going to just read it to you, and this podcast is going to be about it, and I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to comment, make a commentary myself on this wonderful poem. So anyway, this Rorwe Dorje was so helpful, and he often lived in the Wutaishen, the five-mountain complex in northwest China, right on the edge of northeast Tibet and southern Mongolia, holy to Chinese, Mongolians, and Tibetans, as the pure land on a magical level of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva or Buddha of perfect wisdom. And so he lived there a lot, and I think he probably had this poem come to him at that place, as he had several other poems, which are called Damgur in Tibetan, which means an enlightenment song, or a view, so literally a view song, because the Buddhist scientific tradition considers enlightenment when to be occurring when your view of reality is truly realistic. So in other words, you really understand reality and you have a view of its reality. So I translate it an enlightenment song, but it's really a view song, Damgur, but it means realistic view. And only an enlightened being has a realistic view, they say. He wrote this ecstatic poem called, literally again, Identifying Mother Emptiness, Identifying the Mother, actually, basically, he said. And I translated it as Recognizing Mother Emptiness. So I give away one of the things in the title, but never mind. That's a little free translation. Okay, so in Recognizing Mother Emptiness, an enlightenment song, then his first line, Sabmotenjungi denyed ngotsar, he says. Sabmotenjungi denyed ngotsar. So he says, oh, profound reality of relativity. Oh, wonder. That's how he begins. Tantarowe, high there up on the sacred five-mountain pure land of Manjushri. May the Guru who nakedly reveals this as it is, his kindness irrepayable, be enthroned in my heart. I will speak spontaneously whatever comes to mind. Although literally he says, Gangden Toljungi Tsiktu Mao, I'm going to, I must express three words that rise spontaneously, whatever I think of. First thing I think of, type of thing. He writes like that. But I will speak spontaneously whatever comes to mind. Then, so that's like a little prefatory thing. And it indicates it's an enlightenment song, so it's not following a sort of a path of a systematic path or outline or something, you know, to convey something to people. It's just spontaneous, ecstatic even, expression. So then he says, I was just like a mad child, long lost his old mother. Never could find her, though she was with me always. So, you know, Winnicott's description of the good enough mother is the one who creates such a strong sense of security in the child by having such a strong sense of security in herself and love for the child, that when the child is sitting in the next room, because the mother can't hold him and cuddle him or her, hold her and cuddle him or her always, but yet that child sitting in that other room feels the total presence of the mother, because the mother has sort of impressed her lovingness, her effectiveness, her skill, her adroitness in handling the issues of a baby, food and cleansing and digestion and the whole thing, that she has created a field in the baby's mind where the baby is completely surrounded by the mother at all times. So the idea that the mad child, the long lost, is over, and then those who fail to get that good enough mothering, or after a while it ran out, or they can't remember it, or whatever it was. Anybody who's reasonably mentally healthy did get it, even though later they may have fought with their mother over adolescent issues or whatever, personality struggles. But they all had that kind of sense of security from the mother to get that basic trust, which came up in our discussion. Eric Erickson's famous primary thing about basic trust of the universe coming from one relationship with one's mother. You know, that good enough mother, as he put it. Not an overdoing helicopter mother and not like a callous, non-caring mother, but the good enough one. So I was just like a mad child, long lost his old mother. Never could find her, though she was with me always. Which he now knows that means. That's why he's so wondrously excited about it. But now it seems I'm about to find that kind old Amma, mother, since Big Brother Relativity hints where she hides. I think, yes, yes. Then, oh, no, no. Then, could it really be? Now, this is so interesting. Why on earth does he need Big Brother Relativity to hint where the mother hides, since the mother is his all and his everything? You know, why? And in a way, maybe relativity is not quite the mother, but there's the Big Brother. It's so interesting. Well, everything we do and see and think and say and feel, everything is all relativity. It's all Big Brother relativity. Although Big Brother is when you're thinking of it as something nice. And Big Brother is like also the psychologists go crazy with that. Big Brother in Asian cultures is like a kind of father figure. If a father dies in a family, then Big Brother takes over the role of the father, the eldest brother. And so there's a big deal about Big Brother, you know, it has authority. You know? Well, if Big Brother is relativity, you see Big Brother everywhere. And then the fact of understanding that relativity, which is what gives you the understanding of emptiness, is where you look, you realize you might be, or you someone suggests to you, it takes a challenge, actually. So someone, because normally we just think, well, we see what we see, and it's just out there, you know. And, you know, like once we know the words, that's a book, you know, this is a table, you know, we know what it is. And there's no problem, end of problem. But then someone challenges that, or some experience of ours makes us challenge that. Maybe we're not seeing what it really is. Maybe it's something other than what we think. And so we decide we'll try to find out the real reality of the book or the table, or, of course, most importantly, ourselves, because we think there's something in us that's an absolute us, something in the table that's our absolute table. Plato called it table-ness. And various metaphysicians in naive philosophies have had terms for that thing in itself, in the thing that makes the thing, so to speak. Kant talked of thing in itself. Well, when we look more closely to find that thing in itself, when we get that challenge, then what we discover is there is no thing in itself. It's just relative. And that's when we begin to see Big Brother relativity really is amazing. Everything is relative. And actually, the ultimate reality is just the emptiness of those relative things, of any non-relative thing. And that's when you really can get a good look at Big Brother relativity. Then how does Big Brother relativity hint about the hiding of the emptiness, of the voidness, of the absoluteness, absolute reality? Well, in a way, he hints at it because the absolute reality itself is empty of itself. The Buddha's insight, the insight of emptiness or selflessness or voidness, is that if it's outside the relative world, it's irrelevant to the relative world. Because if it's connected to by the relative world, it's embraced within the relative world, and it's just another piece of the relative world. And so that's why the hint of the Big Brother, of the pure relativity, is simultaneous with your discovery of the mother emptiness, is what he's saying. It's hard to do, because we always think of emptiness and voidness as some void or emptiness that's outside of our experience of relational things. And when we have that experience, it is said, I don't think I've had it fully or deeply enough, although I have had some experience, but maybe I haven't had it deeply enough, but it is said that when we totally have that experience, totally, we then become fully relational. So it isn't in an anteroom. There's no antechamber of the full experience, of sort of a place of sort of space where there's nothing solid, but the space itself seems to be, the lack of solidity seems to be solid in the form of a kind of realm of space. And this is easily misunderstood, because, and this makes some modern nihilists who have gotten involved in Buddhist science think that Buddhist science anticipated scientific materialism. They discovered nothingness, and they just conflate emptiness and nothingness, which is a very wrong thing. Although they are very close, but it's very wrong. So Buddhist science was deeper than scientific materialism, and it wasn't dogmatically materialist or dogmatically mentalist. It could use either paradigm in a different context. So anyway, to read this verse again after that commentary, I was just like a mad child, long lost his old mother, never could find her, though she was with me always. And now he knows that. Because it always means that emptiness has to have always been the case. It's not a created thing, because it's not a relational thing. It's itself non-relationality, but that non-relationality itself is just all the relations. It's not something within them or underneath them or beyond them. It is all of them, ultimately. That's the non-dual thing, and that's where the hint of the Big Brother reveals the mother as the Big Brother, in a sense. They become one, you could say. Okay, so that was with me always means it has to be beginningless. It has to be uncreated. Nirvana, emptiness, is uncreated. So therefore, it's never destroyed. But now it seems I'm about to find that kind old mother, since Big Brother relativity hints where she hides. I think, yes, yes, he's describing his enlightenment experience. And then, no, no, he thinks. And then, could it really be? That's so cute. And then he expresses his realization, these various subjects and objects are mother's smiling face. She's smiling because she supports the relativity of everything. And one of the key relativities is that of between subject and object, sentient being and insentient object. And so everything, even in the divided way, and even when you're wrongly misperceiving them because you still think they have kind of an essential core, And you yourself, your consciousness has an essential core. Your subjectivity has an essential core of your essential absolute self. But that, and even this erroneous way of interrelating with everything is the mother's smiling face. In other words, none of that escapes emptiness, because it is emptiness. Emptiness is it. But these births, deaths, and changes are mother's lying words. So here he's saying that they're mistaken, although they're words, but they're lies, that there's birth and death and change, and that actually everything is perfectly blissful, bliss void indivisible. The undeceiving mother has deceived me. My only hope of refuge is in brother relativity. So now even the notion that there is an absolute, through which by looking for everywhere for absolutes, the non-finding of any is itself the finding of emptiness. So that is the mother. So she's undeceiving when you find her, but she allows deception to take place because she's not an absolute that crushes the relative. So my only hope of refuge is in brother relativity, meaning that somehow I have to learn to swim joyfully. And actually, when you swim in relativity, aware that it is the absolute, you swim in joy because you find out that it's perfect. It's totally fitting. You're a being who, as a human, who has evolved to be able to fit in with it beautifully. And you can cure your misunderstanding of it and find that it is just made of bliss. It is bliss. This bliss doesn't underlie it. It is bliss. Therefore, it gives you bliss in every way once you're open to that. You're empty of any defense against that. And furthermore, the many beings that you encounter who don't know that, you are able to, you see them already in bliss, because they always have been. You see them that way. But then you see they don't know it, but then you can play from the level of the bliss of what they really are and the bliss of what you really are and feel you are, unlike them. You then can find out what is the block in their feeling and help them unravel the block in their feeling, if effortlessly, because you see the bliss all around it. But the sole chance, then, as he goes on, so my only hope of refuge is in brother relativity. But the sole chance for freedom is just old mother's love. If this subject-object situation were all there was, the three-time Buddhas could find no way to save us. So the mother emptiness is the one, because we, with our binary mind, everything we experience is relative. So, but we can come up with a concept of the non-relative. And when we then do, and we avoid projecting that non-relative into some sort of outside positive God or into some outside positive nothing, you know, negative nothingness that's fixed and is sort of the absolute thing that is there, when we get free of those things, the only way we can do it is to find out mother's love. That, and mother's love means the teaching of the Buddha. It means the clear light of the void, the clear light of emptiness. It means that emptiness, by not being apart, by allowing no reality apart from the reality of relativity, gives anyone in any point of relativity access to the infinite energy of an infinite relativity. So that infinite relativity can manifest in any seemingly specific way. If the sentiency in that way is open to it. Meaning if the subject-object situation were all there was, that is to say, if we were inevitably alienated and separated from all the objects, then the three-time Buddhas, who are expressions of the mother love, could find no way to save us. So we would block their attempt to save us. But liberation is possible. Now back to the Gorwa Dorje. since these various changes are but the changes of the unchanging mother. So that it is possible, because even the changes, even which are the mother's lies, right, birth, death, and other and changes of suffering, they are still ultimately they are made of the unchanging mother. That is to say, they are allowed, they are enabled by the unchanging mother. So their reality is the unchanging mother. Actually, we need to see through their superficial appearance as changing, and find their unchanging, motherly, deeper nature, which is completely open and blissful, free of suffering. The mutual, and he goes back to him, the mutual interdependence of ineffable mother, where nothing has status, and relativity, where everything appears, is exactly what I must understand. Seeking my old father and just not finding is the actual finding of my old mother. And here the old father is the relative things seeming to have absolute substance or absolute, seeming to have absolute intrinsic reality, inherent existence, essential existence, thing in itselfhood, or whatever, many synonyms, intrinsic identity. But I sought him, therefore. So I didn't automatically just assume emptiness, everything is relative. Because I see things as seeming to fit with their essences, and their essences are what I know them through, it seems to me. So then, but when I really seek that, my old father, I can't find anything. So I didn't find him. And that not finding is the actual finding of my old mother, emptiness. But then from my mother's lap, I find my old father, because he was there without being intrinsically identifiable or intrinsically real, and yet he's relatively real, and he's even able to be misperceived as being intrinsically real. So I found him, but in the lap of the old mother, in the realm of emptiness, I embrace all of the relativities. So of course I find the old father. Then I, child, then from my mother's lap, I find my old father, I, the child of such kind parents, cry out for their refuge. Mom and Dad, be with me. Protect me like the infant. So no wonder the shrink really like this. The infant wants to be picked up and held when it's feeling anxious and stomach pain, has a diaper rash, or has constipation, you know, like intestinal pain, or hunger or thirst, you know. So I, a child of such kind parents, they're kind because they're totally interconnected, cry out for their refuge. When mothers neither one nor many face, meaning that mother is not one and not many, she's both one and many. Seems to be because she is emptiness, and she is all of the things. But she's not only all of the things, she's also their total non-absoluteness. Their total, and in their non-absoluteness, that's their emptiness. And in their emptiness, they're all the same. So they're same. So one or many, neither one nor many. It could be neither same nor different, either same thing. But mothers, neither one nor many face, seems to be there ineffably reflected in the clear mirror of Big Brother relativity. How crazy I was not to start this quest. So in other words, mother's smiling face was right there in every relative thing that I ever saw, because they were relative, because I related to them, because I had changing experiences of them, because relational things always change. And ineffably reflected, meaning it can't be explained how this freedom is the space within which things interconnect. If they weren't free, they couldn't touch each other, they couldn't be interconnected. So the clear mirror of Big Brother relativity, that's an illusory thing, of course, as well. You know, mirror reflection is an illusion. It looks like a three-dimensional thing in there. It looks like intrinsically real three-dimensional space in there. Meanwhile, it's just a flat reflection on the surface. So if it has an illusory quality to it. How crazy was I not to start this quest? So I should have seen it long before by the fact that I was relating to things that they would be empty of any non-relational component. And I should have started the quest much earlier to find the mother emptiness. And then he's a beautiful thing. He says, the generous testimony, in doing that, you need someone to help you. You need to relate to someone. That's the whole guru, teacher, spiritual friend, or virtue friend. A relationship with someone. And you need someone to tell you, to challenge your sense that things have intrinsic essence. And then you have to feel that you're responding to that challenge. So Nagarjuna and some of the great masters like Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, they left instruments for us to discover this weird nature of things. And they left that in texts, which are thought patterns that they encoded in that way to generate similar thought patterns in our minds when we related to them by reading them in the future or by hearing them in the future. So he says, the generous testaments of Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, two of the greatest of the Madhyamakas, were but papers blown away by the wind. So the wind of confusion and greed and fear and all this, and they were just blowing the papers all around until Tsongkhapa, Manjushri's essence, was sent his retriever hawks to get them. Then I was saved. The trials of far questing. There was another line. The generous testaments of Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti were but papers blown away by the wind until Tsongkhapa, Manjushri's essence, sent his retriever hawk to get them. So you have the idea of this hawk flying and catching floating waves and bringing them back without crunching them and bringing back these loose leaf pages that blew away in the wind. The retriever hawk of Tsongkhapa, since he was Manjushri's essence. And Manjushri's essence, Manjushri Garbha, womb actually, it means womb, Manjushri's womb. The word Garbha can mean essence, but it means essence because it's sort of most basic meaning is womb. And that's Tsongkhapa's name nowadays as he lives in the Tushita paradise. And the Dharma, and there's a Dharma center, a university there, among those gods of the Tushita paradise, presided over by Maitreya, the future Buddha. But then that's where Tsongkhapa went when he left his coarse body. So he sent his retriever hawk to get them, and then was I saved the trials of far questing, and allowed to see my old mother naturally here with me. So, by his writing and his teaching and his genius sorting and arranging of the great teachings of the great Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti from 1500 years before to 800 years before, more than eight. So then there's some concluding things which are really fun, where he becomes critical. He has a little friendly, playful criticism of all of the other dogmatic Tibetan sectarians, including his own Kelugpa, New Karampa sectarians. So he says, nowadays some of the bright ones of our school, by that he means the Kelugpa, New Karampa, Atisha derived and Tsongkhapa derived scholars, which was the vast majority, actually, so he puts them first, fond of terms such as self-sufficiency and truth status, quote-unquote, seem to put aside what obviously appears before them and seek some fabulous unicorn to be critiqued. That is to say, they think that the non-emptiness, the intrinsic realities and things, are some super subtle thing somewhere else, and they're not evident to us to our misconception, so that we see them right on the surface of things. The thing seems to be an absolute thing when we see it. Things seems to be a thing in itself. So they are thinking there's some subtle thing, and we're not rejecting what's right in front of us. They never acknowledge this obvious appearance. They explain and explain, not hitting the crux. And that old mother completely escapes them. So they don't really go all the way. They don't plunge past nothingness, but actually almost dive into it, you know, because it will automatically appear, because the last phenomenal object or the last conceptual object that we then can make into an object, as modern materialism has so hugely done, is nothing. So we can think when we look at a dark space that there's no, that's nothing. You know, and that's why we make a mistake about nothing, because we reify it, we make it into a thing. And then mother completely escapes us. Though things surely do exist somehow, their reality seems not to be this horned incompatibility. Since the intimacy of father-mother union seems inseparably tender and cozy. So relativity and emptiness are totally cozy. They're intimate. They're in union. It's a primal scene. The mother is emptiness, the father is relative things. And the relative things never go into any non-relative. So the fact that the non-relative is the relative is what brings father-mother union into tenderness and coziness. And then he gets rid of a bunch of Indian sectarians. He calls them the systematists, as the Vaibhashikas, the traditionists and the idealists, and the dogmaticist centrist masters. Don't worry about that. I'm not going to explain all of those. Those are different worldviews, different levels of structural view or belief that Buddhist philosopher scientists hold, which have a use for them at the level they're at, but are ultimately rejected by the Buddha himself and what is called the Dhyana, and by later ones who think they understand the Buddha's own view as the view of no view, called dialecticist, by me, called dialecticist centrism. But which doesn't mean that they don't own up to holding the view of no view, and that in a way is a view. They do. You know, some of them don't, and then those are critiqued within their own ranks. But anyway, so he doesn't mention them because that's considered the right one. He just goes up to the dogmaticist centrist, not the dialecticist centrist. Anyway, they describe the mother's snow-white elephant body. I love that. The snow-white elephant is how Buddha came to be reborn in his mother's womb. She perceived in a dream state a snow-white elephant coming toward her and merging with her body. Not sexually, just the whole elephant merged with the body in a blissful dream. And so that's kind of interesting. And in general, you know, Buddha had a white elephant, and Siddhartha did have one, and it's considered a very auspicious thing, a white elephant. It's no white elephant body, symbol of prosperity and strength and security and so forth, the snow white elephant is, with such a wide variety of designations, so that these other previous scientists did. The first one, the systematists call it, and the traditionists think of the mother of ultimate reality as the fierce striped tiger of substantial objects. The idealists think of her white elephant as the brainless mad monkey of pure subjectivity. That's so great. And the dogmaticist thinks the powerful bear of self-sufficient non-duality. So non-duality and ultimate absence, which is only superficially, intrinsically real. He thinks superficial and intrinsic can be modified, the same thing. It's a very subtle difference, but I'm not going to go into it in too much length in this because it's an enlightenment poem. But someone who's studied these things and is aware of the levels of Buddhist science and the sophistication of it, this is very meaningful and very humorous. A fierce tiger, a brainless monkey, and a bear of self-sufficient non-duality. You know, because how can non-duality be self-sufficient? Self-sufficient means it's sufficient in itself, apart from other things. Then that's dualistic. But they all lose sight of the presence of our old, dear old mother. The many sages of Sakya, Nyingma, Kagyu, Drukpa, and so on, these are other sectarian groups, proclaim their traditions, various conventions for her. Subjectless clarity, voidness, self-awareness, ta-da. primal, spontaneous, true face of Samantabhadra, the all good Buddha and Bodhisattva. Non-artificial, the innate great gesture, a great seal. Freedom from assertions beyond something and nothing. These are all different versions of the different sectarian schools. And none of them really are wrong, but the dogmaticness of it is what he's against. It is fine as these all do hit on the real situation. In other words, he admits that they touch reality. But let them press down a little on their own noses and ask themselves honestly, is it really so? And what he means, pressing on the nose, is a gesture of the ancient Indian and Tibetan Buddhist art of scientific debate, of developing external debate with a living opponent, with another being, to challenge you to develop deeper inner debate with your own negative and obstructed and confused thoughts. And when you really defeat someone, when they really lose it in the sense of they find their self-contradiction of whatever it was, the idea is that their nose gets pressed. They'll have pressure on the nose and ask themselves honestly, is it really so? And also the other thing is not that anything they say is wrong, it's just that when they get dogmatic that it's just this and just that, which they tend to do, they're forgetting that from the very beginning Buddha said that it was inexpressible. The reality. It cannot be expressed. The non-dual reality, bliss, void, indivisible, cannot be expressed in a formula. It cannot be captured by concepts. It goes beyond them, except for that pure negation, which in a way is a concept, but that opens you out into the realm beyond concepts. So asking yourself honestly, is it really so, is a way of saying that, well, that's a formula you're saying, but it has to be always more than any particular formula. And therefore, Buddhist science was extremely modern and non-dogmatic, according to the strictures set forth by the great Karl Popper, his philosophy of science, that all seeming laws of nature are hypotheses awaiting falsification by further investigation and incorporating further evidence. That seems to contradict what they seem to be by incorporating whatever evidence they were aware of. So in other words, there's no absolute dogmas. So then he goes through them all. He says, "Clear, cheer up, you realists. No need to be nervous, since external things are not done away with. Cheer up, you idealist philosophers. Validation works even without apperception." Apperception, Kantian apperception, means where the philosophical thesis that when you know something, you know you're knowing it simultaneously, which is very problematic. Many people say you first, when you know something, you're focused on the something, and then you notice that you know it, but that's a shift back and forth. It's impossible for them to be simultaneous, is the other view. But apperception is meant to mean that type of self-awareness in the process of other awareness that's simultaneous. So he's saying validation works even without apperception. So, you know, the idealist thing is based on the apperception guaranteeing the validity of perception. But it doesn't. Without it, you can still have validation, he's saying. Cheer up, you dogmaticist centrist masters. Relativity has beauty even without identifiability. Identifiability intrinsic means intrinsic identifiability. And intrinsic identifiability means that the book has an intrinsic book essence that enables it to be identified by my concept of a book. That's called the intrinsic. It's the subtlest form of intrinsicity, of non-emptiness, of thinking that there's an essential essence in things, is thinking that there's something in it that is the referent of my concept of book or whatever object it is. No need to worry, you holders of personal lineages. It's fine even to hold clarity, voidness compatible. So that's okay. You know, the vividness of relational experience and the voidness of them seeming to disappear, they are compatible anyway. You know? Your mystic sages need not insist on all goodness, since even in primal purity, good and bad still apply. Your wise old sages need not to be too stubborn, since the orgasmic comes even from willful meditation, and you hard-headed critics don't get too excited. And this is covered what was I thinking? I lost track. I'm getting into primal purity, good and bad still apply.
Well, it's
because even you're pure, you're primally pure. That means that and therefore everything seems good to you, but you see the badness of others not seeing that simultaneously. So you encompass these things which you can't do with verbal concepts, but you can do with your cognitive dissonant rectifying or compatibilizing awareness of enlightenment. That's what it is. So hard-headed critics don't get too excited. It's fine to assert freedom from both something and nothing. I acknowledge, of course, that those unfamiliar with texts cannot know the technicalities of using such conventions. So it is not that I do not respect their attainments. If any feelings have been hurt, please do forgive me. He now nice and humbly says that, you know, in other words, he knows a lot of these people are yogis or they're experientialists, and they're not really fussing around with all these super subtleties of the intellect that actually ultimately are necessary, but they didn't do it, so they're still getting in good places without even doing it. So I don't mean not to respect their attainments. And so if my feelings have been hurt by my pressing on their noses, please do forgive me. It was just playful debate, helping them to be more deep into what they want to be deep in. Then he says, though by no means am I heir to omniscience. I really love this. I have to learn this one again. I have to remember it. I memorized it in Tibetan, but I forgot. Though by no means am I heir to omniscience, through skill with the reins of analysis and devotion, I rode well the fine stallion of the ancestral texts and won our freedom from the dangerous abyss. That's really, really excellent. And they are like a fine stallion, you know. They really are. And the reins are analysis and faith, you know, and devotion. So by no means am I heir to omniscience. Through skill with the reins of analysis and devotion, I rode well the fine stallion of the ancestral texts and won our freedom from the dangerous abyss. No need, now he gets a little ecstatic toward the end. No need to seek her. She's the seeker himself. Don't cling to her truth. She is utter falsehood. So in other words, don't cling to emptiness. You know, Nagarjuna says that. He says, emptiness is itself a medicine for all afflictions and addictions. But who grasps emptiness as the cure, that person, then there's no medicine for them. They've used up the medicine, has become a poison to them because they suck on that medicine by absolutizing emptiness. So don't cling to her truth. She is utter falsehood. Don't, because she's also empty. Don't negate her falseness. And don't get upset about that, because her falseness is in fact herself. It is truth itself. That's so cool. It's sufficient to rest in the absolute unceased. So the unabsolute unceased, you know, so the unceased and the uncreated and everything is considered the absolute. But since the absolute, when it's emptiness, Buddha's discovery is that when the absolute in fact ends up merely as emptiness, then it's also empty of itself. And therefore, in a way, it's like saying there is no absolute that's relevant to the relative, and therefore the absolute is the huge, vast, infinite relativity. But due to its infinity, it possesses infinite energy. So it therefore is like love. It can solve any kind of inadequacy or any deficit. It can fulfill any deficit. That's the unabsolute, unceased. Though I don't see my mother, so that's the thing, you don't see emptiness because you are emptiness. So Michael Roach or anybody who has an experience of things dropping away and like a spaced out experience, and thinks that they've realized emptiness, and then gets all arrogant about from the memory of it. That's a terrible, terrible mistake. Zen calls that, couched in different terms, being trapped in the demon ghost cave of thinking you're enlightened. Though I don't see my mother by her mere name, I seem to meet my long-lost kindly parents as if in face-to-face embrace encounter. So that's wonderful. That's the inference, you see. The name is in the conceptual realm. It's used and it becomes inference. It becomes father of inference, of reasoning, of critical investigation, as if in face-to-face embrace encounter. Great thanks, O Nagarjuna and sons. Great thanks, O Dzongkhapa Lama and Lama. Great thanks, O my kind Guru Lama. As for the way to repay all your kindness, let us honor our mother emptiness. And then finally he says, he rejoices in his happiness, feeling cradled by mother emptiness while in the midst of the relativity. My unproduced, inexpressible old mother cradles gently the tiny infant of my intelligence. With the banquet of her perfectly good expressions, may she lead all beings to true happiness. Emala Rolwe Dorje Ahol Ahol, my dance of joy. Ahola. Then he just sing. With the banquet of her perfectly good expressions, may she lead all beings to true happiness. And then, just in case you think that since emptiness is something discovered by Buddhist scientists, that this means may emptiness make all beings be Buddhist so they can all be happy, and therefore this is kind of a religious conversion thing. It isn't true. Emptiness can be taught anywhere without Buddhism. It is taught by quantum physicists, the ones who are deeply experimental. And it's an educational thing. And, you know, Christian mystics and Sufi mystics and Hindu mystics, they all found emptiness also. And they found that it was relativity and hence their great good works and love and compassion for humanity. So it doesn't mean Buddhism, is what I'm saying. So the banquet of her perfectly good expressions is a bunch of scientific texts. And then through them, may she lead all beings to true happiness, to find out happiness as Christians, Jews, Hindus, Taoists, whatever they are, or secular humanists. May they find true happiness. And may she help them find that. She, the mother emptiness. Then he goes, Emala Rolwe Dorje Aola, my dance of joy, Ahola, honor the three jewels. So that's the thing. That's my podcast for today.
The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Tashi Dalek, and may all beings be safe.